Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the theory that even the most powerful movements start small, the question today is, where will the protests known as Occupy Wall Street wind up? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk since 1923, combining drug discovery with technology to turn science into diabetes treatments at novonordisk-us.com. And by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information at massmutual.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It's the 3rd of October today, which makes this week number 3 of the protests that have come to be called Occupy Wall Street. A smallish group of activists camped out in a New York City park has become a string of much bigger street protests. There were hundreds of arrests this weekend on the Brooklyn Bridge, and there are new encampments all over the country today. Marketplace's Eve Troe explains how it all got started.
The genesis of Occupy Wall Street might be an email from the anti-consumer magazine Adbusters. It called for action starting September 17th, and that is when activists like Issam Christie gathered. Their goal?
A blossoming social movement in the United States to fight economic, political, and cultural injustices.
General Assembly meetings happen daily, ideally to crystallize one set of demands. But as more political and labor groups jump in, their specific goals have to get added to the mix. The group's now so big, meetings lean toward logistics, food, dry socks, legal aid for those arrested. No amplifiers allowed in the park, so messages go through a system called the human microphone.
Please come!
Please come! Please come!
To the outreach table!
To the outreach table!
Dozens more cities have sprouted protests. In Los Angeles, about 100 people camped near City Hall. They had to move once due to a Hollywood film shoot. Film student Joe Briones is coordinating camera crews for the protest.
You know, a lot of people here are the disenfranchised. They don't have the means to get to New York. How are they going to get there?
Which is why the name Wall Street might be dropped, and the movement shortened to simply Occupy. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
It's always tricky to ascribe motive to other people, let alone hundreds of other people. But part of the story of Occupy Wall Street revolves around these two questions. What do they want? And where have they been? The recession and the bank bailout and the worst excesses of the housing boom are years old by now. So for some perspective, we've called Jeremy Suri. He's a professor of history at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Why now?
Well, I think there are two things we need to look at. First of all, protests never occur right after the event. Generally, they take time to organize. They take time to coalesce. People take time to communicate and form an esprit de corps. But the main reason, the second point I'd make, is that this is occurring today because after the debt crisis issues of the last few months, people are intensely worried that they're going to face major cuts in their education budgets, in their social service budgets, and that the people on Wall Street are getting off scot-free.
Is it possible that it's also just difficult to organize economic protest in the richest country in the world?
It is to some extent. And in addition to being the richest country in the world, we're a country filled with optimists. So people always assume that we're going to come out of a recession stronger than when we went in. But the data and the experience of the last few years have belied that assumption.
Does it matter that they don't seem to have not a narrative, but a theme of protest? You know, they're against a whole lot of stuff.
Right. It is a big problem that they don't have an alternative. This is always the Achilles heel of protest movements of this sort. We could say the same thing about many of the movements in the late 60s as well. You have to be against something, but you also have to be for something. And unfortunately, they're not offering any cohesive or coherent alternative to the capitalist system as we know it. But maybe they will. Give them some time.
One thing I've been amused by is the number of intellectuals coming out and saying, all right, well, you don't have a plan for something, but here, try these 14 different points that I've been trying to work on. Or, you know, Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times today saying, do this and do that.
Well, Kai, this is a pretty typical phenomenon of what I would call protest entrepreneurs, those who see a situation as an opportunity to put forth an idea that they've been espousing for a long time and been unable to get traction for. And historically, most of the ideas that come out of protests are not new ideas. They're old ideas that people start believing for the first time. The best example of this is Marxism. Marx had been writing since the mid-19th century. It was only the early 20th century that his ideas really got picked up.
If you look at certainly the videos and some of the interviews with people who have been down there, it doesn't appear that there are a lot of truly downtrodden people there. You know, I mean, the downtrodden people are at work.
That's correct. And this is one of the hardest things for observers of protests to grapple with. Protests are rarely driven and rarely populated by the most poor and suffering elements of society. People who protest are people who have time, have a means of communicating, have a way of exchanging ideas, and have the resources to get themselves to the protest and to feed themselves once they're there. Mm. This would be as true of the civil rights movement and the anti-war protests of the 60s as it would be of this today.
So based on what you've seen and read about these protests, where do they go from here? What happens?
Well, I don't think they're going to end very soon. I think we're going to see continued anguish expressed on the streets and continued sympathy around the country. And I think, quite frankly, people on Wall Street and in Congress are going to have to come up with a persuasive narrative about how they're addressing these concerns.
Jeremy Suri is a professor of history at the University of Texas, Austin. His most recent book is called Liberty's Surest Guardian. Jeremy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
State attorneys general share some of the protesters' anger at the banks, if not the willingness to take to the streets. Because for a year or more, all 50 state AGs have been trying to pull together a multi-billion-dollar settlement that would force the banks to own up to some of their worst mortgage excesses. But the United Front seems to be faltering. California has pulled out of the talks. Others are likely to follow. And it was, ironically enough, 3 years ago today that the TARP went into effect, the $700 billion bank bailout that was supposed to bring the economy back from the brink, which it did, and help struggling homeowners, which it really didn't. Marketplace's Elisa Roth looks at what went wrong and where things stand today.
Almost 3 million homeowners who are facing foreclosure have sought help from the government through a TARP-funded program. Only a quarter have managed to get their mortgage payments reduced. Adam Levitin is a professor at Georgetown Law School. He says the program had a fatal flaw in the way it was constructed.
It tried to approach the housing market in a way that it helped homeowners it thought were deserving, rather than just saying we need to have a macroeconomic impact here and it's about numbers, not about morality.
The Treasury says the plan wasn't intended to prevent every foreclosure. The program offered cash incentives to mortgage servicers to reduce mortgage payments for borrowers, but the conditions made it hard for a lot of homeowners to qualify. The government's only spent about $2 billion of the $50 billion the Treasury set aside. Levitin says,
the problem is that the allocation for housing, even if they had spent every cent of it, was too small by an order of magnitude.
Though TARP was wound down a year ago, homeowners can still apply for help through the Foreclosure Prevention Program. Neil Borofsky was the inspector general for TARP until he resigned earlier this year. He says the housing market needed more than just reducing the interest payments on mortgages.
There are just too many homeowners who owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. And the underwater mortgages can really only be addressed through a strong principal reduction program.
Reducing the balance on home loans was never part of TARP, and it's been a stumbling block for other efforts to resolve the housing crisis. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, do we really have to? Yeah, I guess we do. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's never a good thing when trading in a specific company's shares is halted on one of the major exchanges. So it follows that being halted twice or more is bad, right? Try being halted 7 times, and you're up to speed on American Airlines today. Rumors of bankruptcy have been swirling all day. At one point, shares were off 41% when they were trading, that is, to lows not seen since September of 2001. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner explains the turbulence.
Rumors that American might file for a Chapter 11 bankruptcy have been in the air for some time. The airline is carrying loads of debt, but unlike its rivals, has no dance partner to help pay the bills. Finance professor and airline expert Richard Gritta.
You know, while the music was playing, United and Continental merged, and so did Delta and Northwest. And American is sitting there alone, and now the music stopped, and they've got a problem.
Today, an industry group said traveler demand had fallen off since July, and the industry is bracing for tough times ahead. Gritta says an American Airlines bankruptcy could have real effects.
If they disappear, you know, if there were an outright bankruptcy or they were sold off, you would see prices go up.
American isn't commenting on its stock price, but says a bankruptcy filing is, quote, certainly not our goal or our preference. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There's big happenings in the business of media news today. ABC News and Yahoo are teaming up online. ABC is going to provide original content for the web, featuring the likes of Katie Couric and Barbara Walters and the rest of the ABC cast. Because despite its troubles, Yahoo is still the number one place that people go for new content online. But to keep that audience happy, you got to give them something to click on. Marketplace Jennifer Collins reports now on the return of content as king.
The online news business is tough, and I'm not just talking about reporting. Your original news story can easily be reused by someone else, whose site then gets traffic and ad revenue. Will Richmond of consulting firm Broadband Directions says that's what makes the ABC deal so important. It goes beyond the headlines.
You know, ABC, by leveraging its personalities, adds a little bit of entertainment value to the news product.
But why would ABC go to Yahoo for this deal? Yahoo recently fired its CEO, and there's been talk it's trying to sell itself. In a video promoting the partnership, Diane Sawyer says ABC could increase its online audience fivefold.
To be able to reach and engage and interact and share stories with 100 million Americans, it's more than just exciting. It's a game changer.
Bernard Gershon, a digital strategist and former executive at ABC, says web traffic doesn't happen by itself. Something attracts it.
And the high-quality content is not going to come out of outer space.
Analyst Alan Gould of Evercore Partners says this deal demonstrates how important original content for the internet has become, with so many sites competing for your attention.
As long as there's multiple players trying to buy unique content, it's nice to own that content.
How long Yahoo remains its own company? That's another matter. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
You have basically two choices when a household appliance breaks, right? You can try to fix it yourself, or you can bring it to a repair shop. But both of those options presume a functioning supply chain that provides replacements for whatever widget needs replacing. That is not a luxury enjoyed everywhere. And in the African country of Mozambique, you have to wait a long time for spare parts. So consumers there have found an old-school solution. Rowan Moore-Garrity has the story.
Makonde wood carvers are renowned for their precision. They can carve realistic rhinos and towers of interlocking bodies out of a single piece of wood. Beto Vasco-Varez is part of a collective of wood carvers here in Nampula, in the north of Mozambique. Working on a mat in a shady courtyard, he uses the same handmade tools that the Makonde always have.
There's the gouge, the handsaw, the hatchet, and the chisel.
Young Makonde sculptors apprentice for years sanding and polishing the works of their teachers. They study the ornate canes and traditional busts that sell well with tourists. But the expert woodcarvers are also finding a market for more functional sculptures. Manuel Xavier is a customer here. He repairs gas stoves for a living, but has trouble finding spare parts.
Here in the north, there's a lack of equipment for gas stoves.
A month ago, Xavier got a call from an unhappy customer. She said that the knobs on her stove had broken off.
I told the woman who owns the stove that part isn't sold here in the north, not in stores or anywhere else, so I decided to have them made out of pau preto.
Pau preto is what they call the wood in Portuguese. In English, it's known as African blackwood or ebony. Rob Patterson is a rural enterprise consultant here.
It's highly prized for making musical instruments. The black keys on your piano would be made of this, so it's extremely hard.
And versatile. Sculptors have carved parts for espresso makers, sewing machines, and motorcycles, for film projectors, and even computers. Patterson says that storekeepers in Mozambique don't have the capital to keep spare parts in stock. Those that do know that their customers may not have other options.
For example, we only have one dealer for Toyota, which owns an exclusive franchise. I think the companies that control spare parts can overcharge and take advantage of their market position.
For cars, the artists have made interior door panels, gear shifts, and more. Sculptor Julio Konamwimba isn't even sure what car part he's working on. He only knew it came from a Toyota.
The customer just brings it here, and we make the part here, and then he'll take it and put it back in his car, and the car keeps on working.
He knows the cars keep on working, he says, because the owners stop by to say so. And with good reason. According to Konamwimba, making car parts is harder than making traditional sculptures.
With our sculptures, the work is only based on your imagination. For these car parts, you need to make sketches so that it comes out like the original.
The wood is slow to carve, and it grows slowly, too. For a tree a foot in diameter, Patterson says,
you could be looking at 300 or 400 years at least.
Vascovarez is concerned that they won't always get their stock so easily. Precious wood like Bao Preto is disappearing quickly with the rise of illegal exports by large logging companies from China.
They just keep exporting wood and more wood. Soon, when we get to the end, we won't have any more wood.
Even the best wood carvers here can't always get enough work making traditional sculptures. Orders for wooden parts only come from time to time, but maybe it's just as well. Vascovarez told me that not just anyone is skilled enough to carve machine parts out of blackwood. In Nampula, Mozambique, I'm Rowan Morgarity for Marketplace.
Coming up, this might sound familiar.
What's most important to me in this book, I think, is to tell a recession time story. So this guy's having, he has a similar career experience to me in that things were going great and suddenly they fell off a cliff.
The lengths people will go to get by, but first, let's do the numbers. Oh yeah, it was Greece. The Dow Industrial sank 258 points today, about 2.3% to close at 10,655. The Nasdaq plunged 79 points, more than 3.25%, 2335, the number there. The S&P 500 dove 32 points, 2.8%, finished at 1099. We mentioned American Airlines was an especially big loser. Shares landed 33% lower today after that crazy nosedive. Other airlines had a bumpy ride as a result. Delta and United Continental each dropped more than 11% today. Investors weren't even cheered by news that auto sales rose 10% in September over last year. Shares of Ford backed up 3.1%. GM hit the brakes by nearly 2.25% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.75%. You can borrow money, 1.75% for 10 years if you're the federal government. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Innocentive, solving important problems for business, government, and foundations by connecting them to problem solvers from around the world. Innocentive.com, where the world innovates. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for August. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on the economy. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke testifies. And it's World Space Week. The United Nations has chosen the theme, 50 Years of Human Spaceflight. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Indulge me for a moment, won't you, as I fast forward the news cycle to this Friday. It's going to be the first Friday of the month, and as such, will bring us the September unemployment report. We're coming off August's flatline. No new jobs that month. There are 14 million people, give or take, out of work in this country, 9.1% of the workforce, as I'm sure you've heard. But commentator Angela Blackwell makes an important point. That jobs report, it's an average.
The white unemployment rate for this past August was a staggering, heartbreaking 8%. But what most people don't know is that black unemployment was at 8.5% before the recession even began. The black community was already living in a recession long before Lehman Brothers and credit downgrades. And today, the black unemployment rate is nearly 17%. It's doubled since the recession. So how do we get jobs to those who need them the most? It's the three P's. We target the people, places, and projects most neglected before and during this recession. President Obama's call for more infrastructure spending is a great start, but we have to go deeper. Every poor community in America has two things, lots of unemployed people and lots of decaying infrastructure. The school down the road from you needs a new roof. Know what? Thousands of schools in poor communities need their roofs fixed, too. We can get tens of thousands of people at work doing that right now. And that overburdened bus system so important to low-income people, by expanding that, we can get folks building new buses, driving new buses, and riding new buses to work. Thousands of school playgrounds and miles of cracked sidewalks can be repaired in black and Latino neighborhoods. The projects are there, and the scale is big enough to make a real difference right now. These kind of manageable, targeted projects have multiple benefits. They can get up and hiring fast. They can employ people from the surrounding neighborhood. And they're manageable enough that the contracts can be won by small, local businesses, especially minority-owned firms that are more likely to hire black and Latino workers. Not only are these sound investments for today, but they're exactly what these communities need to compete tomorrow.
Angela Glover-Blackwell is the founder and CEO of PolicyLink in Washington, D.C. Send us your thoughts about what you hear on the broadcast. Marketplace.org is the website. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. We spent some time on the Occupy Wall Street protests earlier in the broadcast today, and a lot of the people who are out on the streets in New York and elsewhere call themselves the 99%, the other 99% to be more accurate, as opposed to the 1% of the population that's rich and all-powerful. Author Tony D'Souza might agree that the two protagonists of his new novel belong in that bottom 99th. Before the recession, they were young, upwardly mobile. Afterwards, they've lost almost everything, not least of which was their jobs. So they resort to trafficking high-grade marijuana from California to Florida to make ends meet. The book is called Mule, a novel of moving weight. Tony D'Souza, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
You and the main character in this thing, James Lasseter, apart from the drug-running stuff, you have a little bit in common. I mean, you're both freelance writers, you both get married, you have babies, you lose your jobs, and it goes downhill in the recession unbelievably quickly.
What's most important to me in this book, I think, is to tell a recession time story. And I'm a freelancer. I've been freelancing since long before the recession started. And when the recession hit in 2008, freelancing for me and my career went off a cliff. So this guy's he has a similar career experience to me in that things were going great and suddenly they fell off a cliff at the same time that he's just gotten married and is having a baby, which was also my experience. So while I didn't do the drug running, I did have the...
Let's say that again. I didn't do the drug running.
I didn't do the drug running. I did the investigation into the drug running. I have the journalism side of me really enjoyed that, looking into drug running and money laundering.
I will tell you, it's clear this book is meticulously researched. I mean, I know more now about currency trafficking laws and how you might get pulled over in the state of Texas than I ever would have imagined I would have.
The thing about these people is they're businessmen who run very complicated operations. It involves logistics. It involves people management skills. It involves meeting deadlines. The same sort of
cash flow. I mean, the whole
everything.
Deal.
And on top of all the usual things of running a
a small or mid-sized business, they have to deal with, if they make a mistake, they can go to jail for a long, long time.
James Laster and his soon-to-be wife, Kate, before the drug-running part of this book starts, they're doing all right. They're getting by, and they're young, and they've got jobs, and life is good. And I want you to read just this little paragraph right here.
We lived in that dream, breathing it, eating it. After more than a decade working in department stores, Kate had just been promoted to general manager of the downtown Metropolitan Apparel. She was 27, pulling in double anything she ever made in retail, feeling as big about things as I was. We were always together in the restaurants and clubs, celebrating our success like an endless coronation. All the loud people around us were doing the same thing.
Is there a generational thing here? I mean, the 20-somethings who knew the boom for so long and then hit the bust pretty hard.
I think it's not just the 20-somethings. I think it's the early 30-somethings. Maybe it's even a bigger group of people. But I think growing up in the 90s, it was a boom time in our country. The 2000s were great, too. It just seemed like it was going to go on without end. And the things we've had to grow accustomed to and cope with and evolve with, I don't think too many of us were prepared for. And, you know, we have master's degrees, we had professional careers, and those jobs don't exist anymore for the most part. It's hard to find work.
There is a flavor, actually, of, desperation, right, in this book. I mean, you got to be desperate to turn to running, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 pounds of marijuana across country.
You do have to be desperate. You also have to be a certain kind of person. So the opportunity to do this sort of thing, it doesn't come around every day. But there are people who turn their backs on it, and their morals won't let them go there. So I wanted to write about people who do go there. And it also allowed me to write about, I think, greed, because they were pretty desperate to get into it. But soon their financial troubles are solved.
Right.
And they keep going.
Right.
It's never enough.
Tony D'Souza, his most recent book is called Mule, A Novel of Moving Weight. Tony, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me in.
You can read the first chapter of Mule online. It's at our website, marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for small businesses designed to help save time, get paid fast, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at Putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, yet another piece of evidence in my developing theory that the economy we've got today is the one we're going to have on Election Day. President Obama's big jobs bill fell apart in Congress this morning. The number two Republican in the House, Representative Eric Cantor, said the House isn't going to take up the whole bill, just pieces of it. And to provide equal time, Reuters quotes a top Democratic aide as saying, yeah, nobody's all that excited about that jobs bill. As it happens, by the way, as of today, 400 days till Election Day. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow sank 258 points, about 2.3%, closed at 10,655. The NASDAQ off 79 points. That's 3.25%, more than 3.25, actually, 2335. The S&P 500 down 32 points, 2.8%, finished at 1099. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time back on The Big Show.
In tribal societies, an average of about 15% of people met their ends through violence. In the 20th century, you get to about 3%.
Freakonomics Radio. What else? I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for it tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.